This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Horse Soldiers, the extraordinary story of a band of U.S. soldiers who rode to victory in Afghanistan, by Doug Stanton, narrated by Jack Garrett. This book is copyrighted 2009 by Reed City Productions, LLC. This recording is copyrighted 2009 by Recorded Books. This novel opens with a Sioux warrior's song. I am the Kit Fox. I live in uncertainty. If there is anything difficult, if there is anything dangerous to do, that is mine. And now, Horse Soldiers.
Prologue. Uprising. Kala-i-Jungi Fortress, Mazar-i-Sharif, Afghanistan. November 24-25, 2001. Trouble came in the night, riding out of the dust and the darkness. Trouble rolled past the refugee camp, past the tattered tents shuddering in the moonlight, the lone cry of a baby driving high into the sky like a nail. Sunrise was no better. At sunrise, trouble was still there, bristling with AKs and RPGs, engines idling, waiting to roll into the city. Waiting. These were the baddest of the bad, the real masters of mayhem, the death dealers with God stamped firmly in their minds. The city groaned and shook to life. Soon everyone knew trouble had arrived at the gates of the city. Major Mark Mitchell heard the news at headquarters 9 miles away and thought, "You're kidding. We got bad guys at the wire?" He ran downstairs, looking for Master Sergeant Dave Betts. Maybe he would know what was happening. But Betts didn't know anything. He blustered, "One of the agency guys came down and told us we got 600 Taliban surrendering. Can you believe that?" Surrendering. Mitchell couldn't figure out why. He thought the Taliban had fled from the approaching forces of the Northern Alliance to Kunduz, miles away. American Special Forces and the Northern Alliance had been beating them back for weeks, in battle after battle, rolling up territory by coordinating airstrikes from the sky, and thousands of Northern Alliance soldiers on the ground. They now stood on the verge of total victory. Kunduz was where the war was supposed to go next. Not here. Not in Mazar. Not at Club Mez. Besides, these guys didn't surrender. They fought to the death. Die fighting, and you went to paradise. Mitchell stood at the dirty plate glass windows and watched. Here they came, a motley crew of the doomed, packed into 6 big trucks, staring out from the rancid tunnels of their scarves. Mitchell could see their heads over the barricade that ringed his headquarters, a former schoolhouse at the junk-strewn edge of the city. The prisoners, who surely included some Al-Qaeda members, were still literally in the driver's seats, with Northern Alliance soldiers sitting next to them, their AKs pointed at the drivers' heads. The prisoners turned and stared, and Mitchell thought it was like looking at hundreds of holes punched in a wall. "Everybody get away from the windows," said Betts. Major Kurt Sontag, Captain Kevin Leahy, Captain Paul Severson, and a dozen other Special Forces soldiers knelt behind the black and white checked columns in the room, their M4 rifles aimed at the street. Behind them, in the kitchen, the local cook was puttering. The air smelled of cooked rice and cucumber. And a radio was playing more of that god-awful Afghan music that sounded to Mitchell like somebody strangling a goose. He had been looking forward this morning to overseeing the construction of the medical facility in town, and the further blowing up of mines and bombs that littered the area like confetti. Each day, a little bit more of the war seemed to be ending. Mitchell had even started to wonder when he would get to go home. He and a team of about a dozen Special Forces soldiers had moved into the schoolhouse only 48 hours earlier. Their former headquarters, inside the Kalai Jangi Fortress, 9 miles off, in Mazar's western quarter, had given them the shits, the croup, and the flu, and Mitchell was glad to have moved out. It seemed a haunted place. Known as the House of War, the fortress rose like a mud golem from the desert, surrounded by struggling plots of wind-whipped corn and sparse cucumber. Its walls towered 60 feet high and measured 30 feet thick under the hard, indifferent sun. The Taliban had occupied the fortress for 7 years and filled it with weapons, grenades, rockets, and firearms, anything made for killing. Even Enfield rifles, with dates stamped on the bayonets, 1913, from the time that the Brits had occupied the area. Before their hurried flight from the city 2 weeks earlier, the Taliban had left the weapons and smeared feces on the walls and windows. Every photograph, every painting, every rosebush had been torn up, smashed, stomped, ruined. Nothing beautiful had been left behind. After 3 years of Taliban rule, there were old men in Mazar with stumps for hands. There were women who'd been routinely stoned and kicked on street corners. Young men who'd been imprisoned for not wearing beards. Fathers who'd been beaten in front of their sons for the apparent pleasure of those swinging their weapons. The arrival of Mitchell and his soldiers on horseback had put an end to that. The people of Mazar-i-Sharif, the rug makers and butchers, the car mechanics and school teachers, the bank clerks and masons and farmers, had thrown flowers and kisses and reached up to the Americans on their horses and pulled affectionately at the filthy cuffs of their camo pants. The locals had welcomed the balding, blue-eyed Mitchell and 2 dozen other Special Forces soldiers in a mile-long parade lining the highway that dropped into town out of the snowy mountains. Mitchell had felt like he was back in World War II, his grandfather's war, riding into Paris after the Nazis fled. Now 36, Mitchell was the ground commander of the 5th Special Forces Group, 3rd Battalion's Forward Operating Base, FOB. It had been a distinguished, nearly 15-year career, headed for the top of the military food chain. His best friend, Major Kurt Sontag, a 37-year-old former weekend surfer from Los Angeles, was the FOB's executive officer, which technically meant he was Mitchell's boss. In the tradition of Special Forces, they treated each other as equals. Nobody saluted, including less senior officers like Captain Kevin Leahy and Captain Paul Severson, members of the support company, whose job it was to get the post-war operations up and running, such as providing drinking water, electricity, and medical care to the locals. Looking at the street now, Mitchell tried to figure out why the Taliban convoy was stopping. If anything went bad, Mitchell knew he was woefully outnumbered. He had maybe a dozen guys he could call on, and those like Leahy and Severson weren't exactly hardened killers. Like him, these were staff guys in their mid-30s, soldiers who had until now been largely warless. He did have a handful of CIA operators living upstairs in the schoolhouse, and 8 Brits, part of a special boat service unit, who'd landed the night before by Chinook helicopter. But they were so new that they didn't have orders for rules of engagement. That is, it wasn't clear to them when they could and could not return fire. Doing the math, Mitchell roughly figured that he had about a dozen guys available to fight. The trained-up fighters, the 2 Special Forces teams that Mitchell had ridden into town with, had left earlier in the day for Kunduz for the expected fight there. Mitchell had watched them drive away, and felt that he was missing out on a chance to make history. He'd been left behind to run the headquarters office and keep the peace. Now, after learning that 600 Taliban soldiers had massed outside his door, he wondered if he'd been dead wrong. The street bustled with beeping taxis, with donkeys hauling loads of handmade bricks to the city center bazaar, with aged men gliding by on wobbling bicycles, and women ghosting through the rising dust in blue burqas. Afghanistan never failed to amaze him. Still, the convoy hadn't moved. 10 minutes had passed. Without warning, a group of locals piled toward the trucks, angrily grabbing at the prisoners. They got hold of one man and pulled him down. For a moment he was there, gripping the battered wooden side of the truck. And then he was gone, snatched out of sight. Behind the truck, out of sight, they were beating the man to death. Every ounce of rage, every rape, every public execution, every amputation, humiliation, every ounce of revenge was poured back into this man, slathered on by fist, by foot, by gnarled stick. The trucks lurched ahead, and when they moved on, nothing remained of the man. It was as if he'd been eaten. The radio popped to life. Mitchell listened as a Northern Alliance commander, who was stationed on the highway, announced in broken English, "The prisoners, all going to Kala-i-Jangi." Remembering the enormous pile of weapons cached at the fortress, Mitchell didn't want to hear this. But his hands were tied. The Afghan commanders of the Northern Alliance were, as a matter of U.S. strategy, calling the shots. No matter the Americans' might, this was the Afghan show. Mitchell was in Mazar to assist the locals in taking down the Taliban. He figured he could get on a radio and suggest to the Afghan commander presiding over the surrender that the huge fortress would not be an ideal place to house 600 angry Taliban and Al-Qaeda soldiers. But maybe there was a good reason to send them there. As long as the prisoners were searched and guarded closely, maybe they could be held securely within the fort's towering mud walls. And then Mitchell thought again of the weapons stockpiled at Kala-i-Jangi. The piles and piles of rockets, rifles, crates of ammo, tons of violence, ready to be put to use. Not the fort, he thought. Not the damn fort. Belching smoke, grinding gears, the convoy of prisoners rumbled past the fortress's dry moat and through the tall, arched entrance. The prisoners in the trucks craned around like blackbirds on a wire, scanning the walls, looking for guards, looking for an easy way out. In deference to the Muslim prohibition against men touching other men intimately, few of the prisoners had been thoroughly searched. No hand had reached deep inside the folds of their thin gray gowns, the mismatched suit coats, the dirty khaki vests, searching for a knife, a grenade, a garrote. Killer had smiled at Captor, and Captor had waved him on. Tashakur. Thank you. Tashakur. The line of six trucks halted inside the fort, and the prisoners stepped down under the watchful eye of a dozen or so Northern Alliance guards. Suddenly, one prisoner pulled a grenade from the belly band of his blouse and blew himself up, taking a Northern Alliance officer with him. The guards fired their rifles in the air and regained control. Then they immediately herded the prisoners to a rose-colored, plaster-sided building, aptly nicknamed the Pink House, which squatted nearby in the rocks and thorns. The structure had been built by the Soviets in the 1980s as a hospital within the bomb-hardened walls of the fortress. The fort was immense, a walled city divided equally into southern and northern courtyards. Inside was a gold-domed mosque, some horse stables, irrigation ditches encircling plots of corn and wheat, and shady groves of tall, fragrant pine trees, whipping in the stiff winds. The thick walls held secret hallways and compartments, and led to numerous storage rooms for grain and other valuables. The Taliban had cached an enormous pile of weapons in the southern compound in a dozen mud-walled horse stables, each as big as a one-car garage, and topped with a dome-shaped roof. The stables were crammed to the rafters with rockets, RPGs, machine guns, and mortars. But there were more weapons. 6 metal Connex trailers, like the kind semi-trucks haul down interstates in the United States, also sat nearby, stuffed with even more guns and explosives. The fortress had been built in 1889 by Afghans, taking some 18,000 workers 12 years to complete, during an era of British incursions. It was a place built to be easily defended, a place to weather a siege. At each of the corners rose a mud parapet, a tower-like structure some 80 feet high and 150 feet across, and built strong enough to support the weight of 10-ton tanks, which could be driven onto the parapet, up long, gradual mud ramps rising from the fortress floor. Along the parapet walls, rectangular gun ports, about 12 inches tall, were cut into the 3-foot-thick mud, large enough to accommodate the swing of a rifle barrel at any advancing hordes below. In all, the fort measured some 600 yards long, about 1/3 of a mile, and 300 yards wide. At the north end, a red-carpeted balcony stretched high above the courtyard. Wide and sunlit, it resembled a promenade, overlooking a swift stream bordered by a black wrought-iron fence and rose gardens that had been destroyed by the Taliban. Behind the balcony, double doors opened onto long hallways, offices, and living quarters. At each end of the fort's central wall, which divided the interior into 2 large courtyards, sat 2 more tall parapets, equally fitted for observation and defense with firing ports. A narrow, packed foot trail, about 3 feet wide, ran around the entire rim along the protective outer wall. In places, a thick mud wall, waist high, partially shielded the walker from the interior of the courtyard, making it possible to move along the top of the wall and pop up and shoot either down into the fort or up over the outer wall at attackers coming from the outside. In the middle of the southern courtyard, which was identical to the northern one except for the balcony and offices overlooking it, sat the square-shaped pink house. It was small, measuring about 75 feet on each side, too small a space for the 600 prisoners who were ordered by Northern Alliance soldiers down the stairs and into its dark basement, where they were packed tight like matchsticks, one against another. There, down in a dank corner, on a dirt floor that smelled of worms and sweat, brooded a young American. His friends knew him by the name of Abdul Hamid. He had walked for several days to get to this moment of surrender, which he hoped would finally lead him home, to California. He was tired, hungry, his chest pounding, skipping a beat, like a washing machine out of balance. He worried that he was going to have a heart attack, a scary thought at age 21. Around him, he could hear men praying as they unfolded hidden weapons from the long, damp wings of their clothing. The following morning, November 25, 2 CIA paramilitary officers, Dave Olson and Mike Spann, kitted up at headquarters in Mazar and prepared to drive across town to the fort. Both men hoped to interrogate as many prisoners as possible. Mitchell was in the school cafeteria, drinking chai and eating naan, a delicious, chewy flat bread, when Spann and Olson walked up. Mitchell knew Olson the better of the two. Spann, a former Marine artillery officer, had joined the agency 3 years earlier. He wore blue jeans and a black sweater, and was of medium height, with severe cheekbones and a crooked smile, his blonde hair cut close. Olson was tall and burly, with a thin salt-and-pepper beard over an old case of acne. He spoke excellent Dari, the glottal hissing language of the local Northern Alliance fighters, and he was dressed in a black, knee-length blouse called the shalwar kameez over beige pants. Mitchell noticed immediately that the two CIA guys weren't carrying enough ammunition. For whatever reasons, they had about 4 ammo magazines between them. Mitchell preferred the standard operating procedure of bringing 4 magazines apiece on a mission. Olson and Spann carried folding stock AK-47s slung over their shoulders, and 9mm pistols strapped in holsters on their legs. Spann carried another pistol tucked at the small of his back in his pants waistband. Neither man had a radio, which Mitchell also thought was strange. But then again, these CIA guys had always brought their own party with them. He figured that whatever Olson and Spann were doing this morning, it was their own educated business. Olson announced, "We're going out to Kala to talk to these guys, see what we can find out." The previous night, there had been a brief gunfight outside the schoolhouse, and Mitchell, sensing that the situation in the city was increasingly tense, had asked Olson if he himself and a couple of his men could go and provide security while the two CIA officers conducted their interrogations at Kala. Mitchell knew that interrogating prisoners was officially the CIA's job, but he was worried about his friend's safety. "No," said Olson, "you guys need to stay away." To Mitchell's thinking, he was a bit nonchalant about the whole thing. All 3 men knew that the prisoners included many hard cases. Chechnyans, Pakistanis, Saudis, the epicenter of Al-Qaeda. The men who had surrendered were the heart of Osama bin Laden's most skilled army. Maybe, just maybe, one of them knew where bin Laden was. "Watch your back," thought Mitchell. Olson and Spann started out the lobby's front door to a truck parked in the circular drive. Beyond the wall, the busy mid-morning traffic buzzed by. The vehicle slipped into the stream of cars, trucks, and donkey carts, and was gone. Sergeant Betts walked up and stood beside Mitchell, watching them go. He said, "I don't like the looks of that." Mitchell asked him why. "I don't know," said Betts. "I'd like a guy to carry a lot of ammo when he leaves." About a half hour later, Olson and Spann entered Kala. At the fort, Abdul Hamid climbed the steps from the basement of the pink house and blinked in the morning sun, his arms tied behind him with a turban. The stairway resembled a collapsed brick chimney as it emerged from the dark hole that reeked of piss and shit. Abdul was led past the pink house, the walls of the fort soaring around him. About 100 other prisoners had already been led into the courtyard, also trussed with their own clothing, arms behind their backs, sitting cross-legged on an apron of trampled weeds, twisting up from hardpan mud. Mike Spann bent down and peered at Abdul. For the life of him, he couldn't figure out where the kid was from or who he was. Arab? Pakistani? Canadian? He studied Abdul's tattered British commando sweater, sensing that the prisoner, what was he, 20, 23, could speak at least some passable English. "Where are you from?" Spann demanded. "You believe in what you're doing here that much? You're willing to be killed here?" No answer came. "What's your name? Who brought you here to Afghanistan?" The kid on the carpet dropped his head, stared at the shalwar kameez bunched around his knees. "Put your head up," Spann yelled. The young man's face was sunburned, his eyes the color of cold tea. Spann let his gaze linger, and then raised a digital camera and framed a shot. The photo would be sent by encrypted satellite communications back to headquarters, where the image would be cross-referenced against a digital lineup of terrorists and known Al-Qaeda soldiers. Mike. It was Olson, lumbering across the dusty courtyard. He'd spent the last 5 minutes talking with another group of prisoners. Olson towered over the young man on the ground. Yeah, said Span. He won't talk to me. I was explaining to the guy we just want to talk to him, find out what his story is. Well, he's a Muslim, you know, mused Olson. The problem is he's got to decide if he wants to live or die. We can only help the guys who want to talk to us. It was Span's turn. Do you know the people here you're working with are terrorists and killed other Muslims? There were several hundred Muslims killed in the bombing in New York City. Is that what the Quran teaches? Are you going to talk to us? Then it was back to Olson. That's all right, man. Gotta give him a chance. He got his chance. Olson scuffed the dirt with his boot. Span, exasperated, hands on hips, looked at the prisoner. Finally, Span said, Did you get a chance to look at any of the passports? There's a couple of Saudis, and I didn't see the others. They agreed that the young man wasn't going to tell them anything, and the two CIA officers started walking away along a gravel path lined by pine trees toward the gate in the middle of a tall mud wall that divided the fort into its separate courtyards. They were headed to the former headquarters to regroup. At one point, Olson turned to see Span stopped on the path, joking with a group of Northern Alliance soldiers. He turned back and kept walking. By the time Olson reached the middle gate, he heard the explosion of a grenade, followed by a burst of gunfire. He turned. Span was frantically attempting to fight off a gang of prisoners who were beating at him with their fists and screaming, Allahu Akbar! God is great. Olson started running toward Span, and as he did so, Span emptied his pistol into the crowd, then reached behind to the other gun hidden in his waistband. He fired and fell to the ground under the storm of flesh. Seeing that Span was down and thinking he was already dead, Olson spun around to see a Taliban soldier running at him, firing from the hip with an AK-47. Olson could hear the snap of the rounds passing, and was amazed he hadn't been hit. The guy kept coming, and finally Olson, momentarily frozen on the spot, raised his pistol and shot him. The man skidded to a stop at Olson's feet. So close, Olson could almost touch him with his boot. He next turned and fired at the crowd of people beating on Span. He was pretty sure he killed a few of them. He sensed he was being rushed again and spun to shoot another man running at him. By now, he was out of bullets. And so he ran. He ran down the path and into the northern courtyard, past the ruined rose garden fronting the grand balcony. He ran up the steps and into the inner courtyard, where he made a phone call, alerting Mitchell and Sontag back at the schoolhouse. I think Mike's dead, Olson said over the phone. I think he's dead. We are under attack. I repeat, I am receiving heavy fire. RPGs were hitting the balcony wall, rocking the place. Back in the southern courtyard, Abdul Hamid had been shot in the leg and lay in the dirt. He tried crawling back to the basement steps, but it was too far. He wondered if he'd ever see his mother again in California. He wondered who the strange men were who had been asking him questions. He wondered if they knew his real name. John Walker Lind. Meanwhile, one of the prisoners walked up and fired twice, point blank, at Mike Span. By the hundreds, the Taliban prisoners jumped up from the ground where they'd been ordered to sit by Span and Olson. They shook off the turbans binding their wrists and looked wildly around, not sure what to do next. Up on the fortress walls, a dozen or so Northern Alliance guards were pouring fire into the courtyard, raking the hard ground, raising divots of mud, mowing men down. Several minutes later, the prisoners found the weapons cache. They swung open the metal doors of the long Connex trailers and beheld hundreds of rifles, grenades, and mortars spilled at their feet. They scooped up the weapons and scattered around the courtyard, crouching behind mud buildings, in bushes, inside storerooms built into the walls. They started returning fire. The air roared. Wounded horses soon littered the courtyard, twitching and braying in the dust as the hot sun beat down. Mitchell arrived with a ground force, half an hour after Olson's call. He pulled up outside the fortress gate, got out of the truck, and gazed up at the walls. He couldn't believe the intensity of the fight. Several hundred guns must have been firing at once. Mortars started arcing over the walls and exploding around his truck. He and his men ran to the base of the fort and started climbing. The wall pitched skyward at about a 45-degree angle. They scuttled up, hand over hand. At the top, out of breath, Mitchell peered at the mayhem below. Dead men were scattered up in the grove of pine trees, blown there by grenade blasts. They hung from the tree limbs, heavy and still, like blackened ornaments. He saw prisoners running among the trees, turning to fire up at the walls. There were 600 of them down there, Mitchell knew, and they wanted out. He again counted the number of his own force. 15 men. 15. Before leaving for Afghanistan, Mitchell had been asked by his commander, "How will you die?" It was a blunt way of asking how he planned to stay alive. Until now, he hadn't given the answer much thought. Massive explosions punched the sky. He figured the prisoners had finally found the mortars. It was only a matter of time before they zeroed in on the guards and the walls. The gunfire was filled with pops, fizzles, and cracks, like the snapping of enormous bones. Mitchell worried that the fighters inside were breaking out. He expected them to pile over the top wall at any moment. In a matter of minutes, something had gone terribly wrong. "We fought so hard, and we won. But now we're losing so damn quickly." He thought of his wife and his two daughters. He had been worried that they were growing up without him. And now he thought, "They'll never know me at all." Mitchell took out his pistol and prepared to be overrun. Part 1. Going to War. Comfort Inn Airport Motel, South Portland, Maine. September 11, 2001. Little Bird woke. Beside the motel bed was a small nightstand, a radio alarm clock, a Bible. Beyond that, beyond the dirty window, a parking lot filled with the cars of commuters, of people on vacation, heading to work, to their families, to the rest of their lives. It had been a peaceful night for Little Bird at the end of a long, restless year. This morning, he was going to heaven. "There is no God but one God, and Muhammad is his messenger." His real name was Muhammad Atta, the nickname given to him by his father, a stern and dour lawyer, who saw Atta as soft and overly sensitive, as too frail, too lazy, too fretful. Hadn't he even timed the young Atta's 3-minute walks home through the streets of Cairo after school, finding fault if he were seconds late? "Little Bird, you take too long. Why?" Arrivals, departures. "There is no God but one God, and Muhammad is his messenger." He rose. Wearing jeans and a blue polo shirt, the floral bedspread smooth and shiny beneath his delicate hands. He looked like another harried tourist, eager to start his day. Overhead, jet airliners roared away, taking off. 10 minutes later, Atta stood at the South Portland, Maine airport, holding a ticket he had purchased on the Internet 2 weeks earlier in Las Vegas. He'd gone there for a final organizational meeting. 4 days earlier, he'd celebrated his birthday in a place called Shuckum's Oyster House in Hollywood, Florida. Through the night, he played pinball and drank cranberry juice, and watched his fellow assassin, Marwan al-Shehhi, drink liquor and look at the women and nod to the music. He hated their touch, women, their smell, their sex. He had 5 days to live. He was 33 years old, and he'd just planned the largest attack on American soil in world history. Still, everything bored him. Eating bored him. Sleeping, breathing. The only thing worth living for was dying. As Atta walked through the metal detector at the Portland airport, he carried a 4-page note in his pocket that read, "When you get on the aircraft, think of it, your mission, as a battle for the sake of God. Do not forget, the true promise is near, and the zero hour had arrived. Always remember to pray, if possible, before reaching the target. Or say something like, 'There is no God but one God, and Muhammad is his messenger.'" By 5:45 a.m., he was through security, along with another assassin, Abdul Aziz Al-Omari. 15 minutes later, Atta's plane took off and swung out over the Atlantic, headed for Boston. There, Atta was to switch planes for a flight to Los Angeles on American Airlines Flight 11. At 6:52 a.m., inside Boston's Logan International Airport, 7 minutes after he landed, his cell phone rang. It was Marwan, also in the airport, calling from a nearby terminal. The two men must have spoken quickly. "Is everything ready?" "Yes, brother. Everything is ready. There is no God but one God, and we are his messengers." And then they hung up. By 7:40 a.m., Atta and his team of four others were seated comfortably, the jet pushing back from the gate. 34 minutes later, United Flight 175, with Marwan al-Shehhi and his four comrades on board, also took off from Logan Airport in Boston. At the same time, 8:14 a.m., Atta proceeded to take control of American Airlines Flight 11. He and his compatriots sprayed mace and yelled they had a bomb on board in order to move the passengers to the rear of the plane. At 8:25, air traffic control in Boston heard a voice say, "Nobody move. Everything will be okay. If you try to make any moves, you'll endanger yourself and the airplane. Just stay quiet." In first class, where the hijackers had been sitting, one man lay slumped with his throat cut. Two flight attendants had been stabbed. They were still alive, one with an oxygen mask pressed to her face, the other with minor wounds. At 8:44 a.m., the plane dipped low over New York City. A flight attendant on board, Madeline Amy Sweeney, was talking on a cell phone to an air traffic controller when she looked out the window and said, "Something is wrong. We are in a rapid descent. We are all over the place." And then, before the line went dead, "We are flying low. We are flying way too low." A few seconds passed. "Oh my God. We are way too low." At 8:46 a.m., American Flight 11, racing at the speed of nearly 500 miles per hour, rammed into the north tower of the World Trade Center. 10,000 gallons of aviation fuel exploded, with a force of 7 million sticks of dynamite. 14 minutes later, on board United Flight 175, which was now under Marwan's control, a young man named Peter Hansen was making a phone call to his father, Lee, back in Easton, Connecticut. "It's getting bad, Dad," he said. "A stewardess was stabbed. They seem to have knives and mace. They said they have a bomb. It's getting very bad in the plane. Passengers are throwing up and getting sick. The plane is making jerky movements. I don't think the pilot is flying the plane. I think we're going down. I think they intend to go to Chicago or someplace else and fly into a building. Don't worry, Dad. If it happens, it'll be very fast. My God, my God." At 9:03 a.m., United Flight 175 hit the South Tower. 34 minutes later, American Flight 77 dove into the Pentagon. At 10:03 a.m., United Flight 93 exploded in a field near Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Cal Spencer had just gotten out of the Cumberland River and was pulling the Zodiacs onto the boat trailers when somebody in the truck said, "Jesus, can't anybody turn up the heat?" Spencer shook off the morning's cold, grumbled, reached over and punched a few buttons on the dash. Then he wheeled the truck for home through the lush Tennessee countryside, the trees along the interstate painted with the first faint brush of autumn. Spencer ticked off the day's tasks, hurry back to the team room, finish up the avalanche of paperwork that always fell on your desk when you finished a training mission, get home, help Marcia make dinner, check in with Jake about his homework, go to bed, get up, repeat. Sandy-haired, wry, with a lanky build of a baseball player, Spencer was usually ready with a sly quip to liven up any dreary moment. But not this morning. The night had been miserable. He'd led 8 Special Forces soldiers up the Cumberland River in the dark, using night vision goggles and a GPS. The work wasn't hard. Spencer had done this kind of thing hundreds of times, and he was bored. They had delivered their package, a second Special Forces team traveling with them, to the predetermined infiltration point on the river, shut down the outboard motors, and waited. They didn't have long. Seconds later, the large shadow of a Chinook helicopter appeared over the trees, floated downward, and hovered just feet above the water. A metal insect descended from the heavens, louder than hell, the twin rotors sending mountains of cold spray into the air. The Hilo was flown by the top-notch pilots of the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, SOAR. SOAR's guarantee was that they would arrive 30 seconds on either side of their scheduled time, no matter what, and they had kept their promise. Created in the wake of the 1980 rescue attempt of U.S. embassy workers in Iran, the Army had determined that poor air support had caused the mission's failure. The SOAR pilots lived a secretive existence, flying exquisitely planned missions in the world's hairiest places. They operated from a base situated behind acres of barbed wire in a remote corner of Fort Campbell, a 20-minute drive down cracked two-lane blacktop from Spencer's own team room. Spencer never knew any of the pilots' names, and they didn't know his. It was better that way. In case the real thing ever happened, if they ever went to war, nobody could compromise anyone's identities. Spencer's team completed the link-up, and he and his men yanked the outboards to life and roared back upriver. Their job was over. Time to get back to the boat landing. And then they ran into fog. They had to stop the boats because some in the group were blindly bumping into the riverbank. Suddenly a barge came steaming out of the dark. The big vessel was headed straight for them. They all sped for the riverbank, where, better safe than sorry, They tied up to some low-hanging tree branches and prepared to spend the night. Spencer hadn't dressed for the cold weather. He sat in the bottom of the boat, wrapped in a poncho, teeth chattering, trying to pretend the chill didn't matter. Sergeant First Class Sam Diller found a bunch of life jackets and piled those on top of himself, eight in all. Yet still, he lay on the boat bottom, shivering. When they pulled up at the boat ramp the next morning, Cal Spencer wanted nothing more than to be curled up at home, martini in hand, watching TV. He thought that maybe at age 40, he was getting too old for this kind of work. As a chief warrant officer, Spencer was the senior man on the team. He was a father figure to the younger guys, and a brother to Diller and Master Sergeant Pat Essex, who had served with him in Desert Storm. Essex was thin and stern, of good Minnesota stock. He had grown up in California, and wanted to spend his retirement years bird-watching. Sam Diller was from a holler in West Virginia that Cal thought probably didn't even exist anymore. He was also, Cal thought, one of the smartest guys on the team. They were all good men. And someday, Spencer mused, they might just get a real mission. As he pondered all of this, news of the first plane heading the World Trade Center broke over the truck's radio. Marcia Spencer was still at home in bed at Fort Campbell when the phone rang. It was her best friend, Lisa, Diller's wife. "Turn on the TV," she said. Lisa sounded freaked out, and that wasn't like her. She was one of the most poised people Marcia knew, tough as nails. Marcia flipped on the set and couldn't believe what she was seeing. The first plane had hit the North Tower, and the building was in flames. Marcia stared at the screen, not comprehending the picture. "Those people," she murmured. And then she thought, "Cal, he'll be leaving soon." "They're going," said Lisa, on the other end, reading her mind. The two women immediately tried to figure out where their husbands would be deployed. What country? Who had done this? Cal had a deployment scheduled in a few weeks to Jordan, a training mission with the Jordanian army. Marcia knew that'd be canceled now. As they were talking, the second plane hit. "Oh my God," the two friends screamed at each other into the phone. "Oh my God." Looking at the TV, Marcia said to her friend, "This one really scares me, Lisa. This one feels different." Something, they knew, had just ended, and something had just begun. Hearing the news of the attacks, Spencer floored the big 5-ton truck, double-timing it to Fort Campbell, headquarters of the U.S. Army's 5th Special Forces Group. The huge post consists of over 100,000 scrubby acres of buckled hills, scorched firing ranges, and humid tangles of kudzu, 61 miles northwest of Nashville. The third largest post in the United States, it actually sprawls between two states, the majority of it located in Tennessee, near Clarksville. Fort Campbell's post office sits in Kentucky, outside the farming burg of Hopkinsville. The entire area is ringed and quilted by strip malls, franchise steakhouses, discount furniture stores, and cornfields. Spencer imagined Marcia at home, watching the news on TV. He knew she was tough, but he didn't know how she'd react to the terrible images. As he drove, he felt sick to his stomach, confused. He was pretty sure that as soon as he got back to base, they'd begin packing to leave. Beyond that, everything was a question mark. The banter in the truck was nonstop. "Can you believe this? Who the hell did this? We're going to war, right?" Spencer could only imagine what was going on in those planes. He'd been in firefights. He had seen people killed and torn up and blown away. But this was different. These were civilians. On September 11, 2001, Dean Nosorog had been a married man for exactly 4 days, a fact that continued to surprise him. He, Dean Nosorog, from a hardscrabble farm in Minnesota, married to the prettiest girl on the planet. At the moment the planes hit, he and Kelly were in Tahiti, asleep in their hotel room, overlooking a black crescent of beach dotted by palm trees. They got up, had breakfast on their balcony, and decided to go mountain biking. Dean, madly in love, felt a world away from his real life. The best part was that he had 2 weeks of this easeful living left. They walked out of the hotel hand in hand, oblivious to the first news reports of the attacks playing out on a TV in a corner of the lobby. As they pedaled up a mountain road, no one passing by would have guessed Dean was a secret soldier in a part of the Army most Americans knew little about, the U.S. Army Special Forces. Sunburned, freckled, with unruly red hair, dressed in cargo shorts and T-shirt, Dean resembled a young pharmaceutical salesman on holiday. He kicked off and sped the bike toward town, yelling to Kelly to catch up. At the bottom of the hill, they pulled into a tiny French pizzeria and ordered. An American woman quickly walked up out of breath and said, "Have you heard?" She was in tears. "A plane," she blubbered. "A plane just ran into a building in New York." Dean looked at Kelly, cocking an eyebrow. "What?" "And there was a second plane," she went on. "A second plane hit another building." Dean's face dropped. "Hurry," he told Kelly. The two of them raced back to the hotel. The lobby was now filled with Americans, all of them, it seemed, also on their honeymoon. Dean pushed up to the TV. Everybody huddled close in shock. Dean watched for several minutes, and then he turned to Kelly. "I've got to make a phone call," he said. He started back toward their room, and along the way paused at the front desk, picking up a copy of the International Herald Tribune. The newspaper's headline stopped him cold. Massoud was dead. The leader of the Afghan people in their fight against the Taliban. The great man had been at war for more than 20 years. The ultimate survivor. Now, he was dead. Not Massoud. Assassinated, September 9, 2001, in Afghanistan. Dean felt that the timing could not be an accident. All week, the lion had been close to dying. He just hadn't known it. Handsome, graying at the temples, with a sharp smile and eyes like black enamel, the lion had been restless. He had decided he would attack the Taliban that night, September 9. In the camp, men had been loading AK-47 magazines with ammo, sorting and counting RPGs, feeding their exhausted shaggy horses, whose neighing and snorting caromed off rock walls scoured by cold mountain winds. Massoud had been fighting the Taliban for 7 years, and, he had to admit, they were about to win. He was boxed into a tiny slice of the Panjshir Valley, his boyhood home, a verdant swath of hills and violet escarpments, facing death. Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters, with the help of foreign Arabs, were pummeling his resistance forces, their last obstacle to taking total control. Still, he vowed to press on. He would never give up the fight. He would bite and claw at the enemy. He would kill, wound, harass. Ahmed Shah Massoud, the Lion of the Panjshir, an ally of the United States and the CIA during the 1979-89 Soviet invasion of the country, was the last chance Afghan citizens had to defeat the Taliban. He had fought the Soviets for 10 years, until they retreated in defeat. And then he had fought the men with whom he had fought the Soviets. Thousands and thousands had died on all sides, and Masoud, although revered, had plenty of skeletons in his own closet. Masoud had been at war for 22 years. In April 2001, Masoud had traveled to Strasbourg to ask for international assistance. There he had said to the press, "If President Bush doesn't help us, then these terrorists will damage the United States and Europe very soon, and it will be too late." Masoud had been describing the Taliban and a man named Osama bin Laden, the billionaire son of a Saudi construction mogul. No one listened. That neglect had given bin Laden the summer to organize a secret plan to kill Masoud. The mastermind was a man named Ayman al-Zawahiri, an al-Qaeda commander. Bin Laden's army, totaling some 3,000 trained soldiers, had merged with the Taliban, consisting of 15,000 farmers and butchers, teachers and lawyers. Together they wanted to return the Middle East to the 14th century, into a golden age ruled by Islamic law. A big step toward that great step back would be the elimination of Ahmed Shah Massoud. In his hotel room, Dean dialed the 5th Special Forces Group Headquarters at Fort Campbell. He got the answering machine of his battalion commander. Frantic, he left a message. "Sir," he said, "I'm in Tahiti. I just saw what happened on TV." He found himself talking way too fast. "I want to talk to you. I want to know what is going on. What do you need from me?" Dean glanced again at the newspaper in his hand. "I'm looking at the International Herald Tribune. The leader of the Northern Alliance was assassinated, according to this article, by bin Laden." Dean knew bin Laden, and he knew Masoud. The famous guerrilla had been the leader of something called the Northern Alliance, a shaky collection of 3 Afghan tribes who'd fought the Taliban. With Masoud dead, Dean knew that the alliance would be in danger of falling apart. Masoud's assassination, and the attacks he'd seen on TV this morning, must, Dean guessed, be a coordinated assault. He hung up, redialed, and started looking for flights to Fort Campbell. At his base camp in the Panjshir Valley, Masoud had been on the phone when the assassins arrived, 2 Arabs traveling on stolen Belgian passports, and posing as television journalists who had cajoled to meet with Masoud for several weeks. He welcomed the visitors, and they seated themselves opposite him. Masoud requested tea for his guests. He had asked to see the list of interview questions while chatting with the cameraman as he set up his equipment. He told them they could begin the interview. The Arab aimed the eye of the lens at Masood's waist. He switched it on. Inexplicably, the camera flashed with blue fire, choking the room with smoke. The fire leaped straight at Masoud. As the smoke lifted, Masoud lay bleeding in the charred hulk of his chair, a hole blown through the chair's back. The cameraman was dead, cut in half by the force of the bomb that had been strapped to the battery pack on his waist. Masoud had whispered to a bodyguard, "Pick me up." Fingers on his right hand had been blown away. His face was a bloody mess. Someone quickly stuffed cotton into his eye sockets. He had been shot through the heart by shrapnel. There was no hope of saving him. His aides stashed him in a refrigerator at a Tajikistan morgue and vowed to stay mum. They feared the resistance fighters would lose heart and run. Within a day of Masoud's death, the hills around Kunduz echoed with rumors of his passing, carried through canyon and river wash by handheld Motorola radios. In a trench far north of the city, a young man from California had settled down in the beige talcum earth and claimed it as Allah's last battleground. Abdul Hamid knew the final battle was near. He had just marched north with 130 other fighters for 100 miles from the city of Kunduz,